There was music from my neighbor's house through the summer nights. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. At high tide in the afternoon, I watched his guests diving from the tower of his raft, or taking the sun on the hot sand of his beach while his two motorboats cut the waters of the Sound. On weekends, his Rolls-Royce became an omnibus, which carried parties to and from the city between 9 in the morning and long past midnight, while his station wagon hurried like a brisk yellow bug to meet all trains. And on Mondays, 8 servants, including an extra gardener, worked all day with mops and brushes and hammers and garden shears, repairing the devastation of the night before. Every Friday, 5 crates of oranges and lemons arrived from New York. Every Monday, these same oranges and lemons left his back door in a pyramid of empty halves. There was a machine in the kitchen which could extract the juice of 200 oranges in half an hour if a little button was pressed 200 times by a butler's thumb. At least once a fortnight, an army of caterers came down with several hundred feet of canvas and enough colorful lights to make a Christmas tree of Gatsby's enormous garden. On buffet tables, decorated with glistening hors d'oeuvre, spiced baked hams crowded against extravagant salads and pastry pigs and dark gold turkeys. In the main hall, a bar with a real brass rail was set up and stocked with gins and liquors and with spirits so long forgotten that most of his female guests were too young to know one from another. By 7 o'clock, the orchestra has arrived, not a modest 5-piece one, but a full pit of oboes and trombones and saxophones and viols and cornets and piccolos and low and high drums. The last swimmers have come in from the beach now and are dressing upstairs. The cars from New York are parked in 5 rows in the drive, and already the halls and salons and verandas are gaudy with primary colors and hairstyled in strange new ways, in shawls beyond any dreams. The bar is in full swing, and rounds of cocktails spread through the garden outside, until the air is alive with chatter and laughter and casual innuendo and introductions forgotten on the spot, and enthusiastic meetings between women who never knew each other's names. The lights grow brighter as the earth leans away from the sun, and now the orchestra is playing yellow cocktail music, and the opera of voices pitches a key higher. Laughter is easier minute by minute. The groups change more quickly, full with new arrivals, separate in form at the same time. Already there are wanderers, confident girls who blend here and there among the stouter and more stable. They become for a sharp, joyous moment the center of a group, and then, excited with triumph, glide on through the sea change of faces and voices and color under the constantly changing light. Suddenly, one of these gypsies catches a cocktail out of the air, dumps it down for courage, and, moving her hands like Frisco, dances out alone on the canvas platform. A momentary hush, the orchestra leader varies his rhythm just for her, and there is a burst of chatter as the false news goes around that she is Gilda Gray's understudy from The Follies. The party has begun. I believe that on the first night I went to Gatsby's house, I was one of the few guests who had actually been invited. People were not invited. They went there. They got into automobiles which took them out to Long Island, and somehow they ended up at Gatsby's door. Once there, they were introduced by somebody who knew Gatsby, and after that, they behaved themselves according to the rules of an amusement park. Sometimes they came and went without having met Gatsby at all, just came to enjoy the party. I had been actually invited. A chauffeur in a blue uniform crossed my lawn early that Saturday morning with a surprisingly formal note from his employer. The honor would be entirely Gatsby's, it said, if I would attend his little party that night. He had seen me several times and had intended to call on me long before, but some circumstances had prevented it. Signed, J. Gatsby, in a majestic hand. Dressed up in white, I went over to his lawn a little after 7. And wandered around rather awkwardly among swirls of people I didn't know, though here and there was a face I had noticed on the commuting train. I was immediately shocked by the number of young Englishmen present, all well-dressed, all looking a little hungry, and all talking in low, earnest voices to solid and prosperous Americans. I was sure that they were selling something, bonds or insurance or automobiles. They were painfully aware of the easy money in the vicinity, and convinced that it was theirs for a few right words. As soon as I arrived, I tried to find my host, but the 2 or 3 people whom I asked about him stared at me in such an amazed way and denied so fiercely any knowledge of his movements that I moved slowly in the direction of the cocktail table. The only place in the garden where a single man could linger without looking purposeless and alone. I was on my way to get very drunk from simple embarrassment when Jordan Baker came out of the house and stood at the top of the marble steps, leaning a little backward and looking with insolent interest down into the garden. Welcome or not, I found it necessary to attach myself to someone before I should begin to address polite remarks to the passersby. "Hello," I roared, walking toward her. My voice seemed unnaturally loud across the garden. "I thought you might be here," she replied absently as I came up. "I remembered you lived next door to..." She held my hand impersonally as a promise that she'd take care of me in a minute, and gave ear to two girls in twin yellow dresses who stopped at the foot of the steps. "Hello," they cried together. "Sorry you didn't win." That was for the golf tournament. She had lost in the finals the week before. "You don't know who we are," said one of the girls in yellow, "but we met you here about a month ago." "You've dyed your hair since then," remarked Jordan. But the girls had moved casually on, and her remark was addressed to the early moon, produced like the supper, no doubt, out of a caterer's basket. With Jordan's slender, golden arm resting in mine, we went down the steps to the garden. A tray of cocktails floated at us through the twilight, and we sat down at a table with the two girls in yellow and three men, each one introduced to us as Mr. Mumble. "Do you come to these parties often?" inquired Jordan of the girl beside her. "The last one was the one I met you at," answered the girl in a confident voice. She turned to her companion. "Wasn't it for you, Lucille?" "It was for Lucille, too." "I like to come," Lucille said. "I never care what I do, so I always have a good time. When I was here last, I tore my dress on a chair, and he asked me my name and address. Within a week, I got a package from Quarrier's with a new evening gown in it." "Did you keep it?" asked Jordan. "Sure I did. I was going to wear it tonight, but it was too big in the bust and had to be altered. It was blue with lavender. Beads. $265. "There's something funny about a fellow that'll do a thing like that," said the other girl eagerly. "He doesn't want any trouble with anybody." "Who doesn't?" I asked. "Gatsby, somebody told me..." The two girls and Jordan leaned together confidentially. "Somebody told me they thought he killed a man once." A thrill passed over all of us. The three Mr. Mumbles leaned forward and listened eagerly. "I don't think it's so much that," argued Lucille skeptically. "It's more that he was a German spy during the war." One of the men nodded in confirmation. "I heard that from a man who knew all about him, grew up with him in Germany," he assured us positively. "Oh no," said the first girl. "It couldn't be that, because he was in the American army during the war." As our attention switched back to her, she leaned forward with enthusiasm. "You look at him sometimes when he thinks nobody's looking at him. I'll bet he killed a man." She narrowed her eyes and shivered. Lucille shivered. We all turned and looked around for Gatsby. The first supper, there would be another one after midnight, was now being served, and Jordan invited me to join her own party, who were spread around a table on the other side of the garden. There were three married couples and Jordan's escort, a persistent student who was obviously under the impression that sooner or later, Jordan was going to give up to him to a greater or lesser degree. "Let's get out," whispered Jordan after quite a wasteful half hour. "This is much too polite for me." We got up and she explained that we were going to find the host. "I had never met him," she said, "and it was making me uneasy." The student nodded in a cynical, melancholy way. The bar where we glanced first was crowded, but Gatsby was not there. She couldn't find him from the top of the steps, and he wasn't on the veranda. We tried an important-looking door and walked into a high Gothic library, paneled with carved English oak, and probably transported complete from some ruin overseas. A fat, middle-aged man, with enormous spectacles, was sitting somewhat drunk on the edge of a great table, staring at the shelves of books. As we entered, he turned excitedly around and examined Jordan from head to foot. "What do you think?" he asked. "About what?" He waved his hand toward the bookshelves. "About that, as a matter of fact. You don't need to confirm. I am certain. They're real." "The books?" He nodded. "Absolutely real. Have pages and everything. I thought they'd be a nice durable cardboard. Matter of fact, they're absolutely real. pages and, here, let me show you. Taking our skepticism for granted, he rushed to the bookcases and returned with volume one of the Stoddard lectures. See, he cried triumphantly. It's printed. It fooled me. This fella's a regular Belasco. It's a triumph. What thoroughness. What realism. Knew when to stop, too. Didn't cut the pages. But what do you want? What do you expect? He snatched the book from me and replaced it quickly on its shelf, muttering that if one brick was removed, the whole library could collapse. Who brought you? He demanded. Or did you just come? I was brought. Most people were brought. Jordan looked at him alertly, cheerfully, without answering. I was brought by a woman named Roosevelt, he continued. Mrs. Claude Roosevelt. Do you know her? I met her somewhere last night. I've been drunk for about a week now, and I thought it might sober me up to sit in a library. Has it? A little bit, I think. I can't tell yet. I've only been here an hour. Did I tell you about the books? They're real. They're... you told us. We shook hands with him and went back outdoors. There was dancing now on the canvas in the garden. Old men pushing young girls backward in eternal graceless circles. Superior couples holding each other fashionably and keeping in the corners. And a great number of single girls dancing individually. By midnight, the fun had increased. A celebrated tenor had sung in Italian, and a famous contralto had sung in jazz. And between the numbers, people were doing stunts all over the garden, while happy, silly bursts of laughter rose toward the summer sky. A pair of stage twins, who turned out to be the girls in yellow, did a comedian act in a baby costume, and champagne was served in glasses bigger than finger bowls. The moon had risen higher, and floating in the sound, there was a triangle of silver scales, trembling a little to the sound of the banjos on the lawn. I was still with Jordan Baker. We were sitting at a table with a man of about my age and a loud little girl who burst into uncontrollable laughter at the slightest provocation. I was enjoying myself now. I had taken two finger bowls of champagne, and the scene had changed before. My eyes into something significant, elemental, and absolute. At a pause in the entertainment, the man looked at me and smiled. Your face is familiar, he said politely. Weren't you in the 1st Division during the war? Why, yes, I was in the 28th Infantry. I was in the 16th until June 1918. I knew I'd seen you somewhere before. We talked for a moment about some wet, gray little villages in France. Evidently, he lived nearby, for he told me that he had just bought a hydroplane and was going to try it out in the morning. Want to go with me, old sport? Just near the shore along the Sound. What time? Anytime that suits you best. It was on the tip of my tongue to ask his name when Jordan looked around and smiled. Having a fun time now? She asked. Much better. I turned again to my new acquaintance. This is an unusual party for me. I haven't even seen the host. I live over there. I waved my hand at the invisible hedge in the distance. And this man Gatsby sent over his chauffeur with an invitation. For a moment he looked at me as if he couldn't understand. I'm Gatsby, he said suddenly. What? I exclaimed. Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought you knew, old sport. I'm afraid I'm not a very good host. He smiled understandingly, much more than understandingly. It was one of those rare smiles that you may come across four or five times in life. It faced, or seemed to face, the whole eternal world for an instant, and then concentrated on you only. It understood you just as far as you wanted to be understood, believed in you as you would like to believe in yourself, and assured you that it had the exact impression of you that you hoped to make. Precisely at that point it disappeared, and I was looking at an elegant young roughneck, a year or two over 30, whose elaborate formality of speech was almost absurd. Sometime before he introduced himself, I'd got a strong impression that he was choosing his words with care. Almost at the moment when Mr. Gatsby identified himself, a butler hurried toward him with the information that Chicago was calling him on the wire. He excused himself with a small bow that included each of us in turn. If you want anything, just ask for it, old sport, he told me. Excuse me. I will rejoin you later. When he was gone, I turned immediately to Jordan to tell her of my surprise. I had expected that Mr. Gatsby, would be a pretentious, corpulent person in his middle years. "Who is he?" I demanded. "Do you know? He's just a man named Gatsby. Where is he from, I mean? And what does he do?" "Now you're hooked on the subject," she answered with a weak smile. "Well, he told me once he was an Oxford man." A dim background started to form behind him, but at her next remark, it disappeared. "However, I don't believe it." "Why not?" "I don't know," she insisted. "I just don't think he went there." Something in her tone reminded me of the other girls. "I think he killed a man," and stimulated my curiosity. I would have accepted without question the information that Gatsby came from the swamps of Louisiana or from the Lower East Side of New York. That was understandable. But young men didn't, at least in my provincial inexperience, I believe they didn't, drift coolly out of nowhere and buy a palace on Long Island Sound. "Anyhow, he gives large parties," said Jordan, changing the subject. "And I like large parties. They're so intimate. At small parties, there isn't any privacy." There was the boom of a bass drum, and the voice of the orchestra leader rang out suddenly above the garden. "Ladies and gentlemen," he cried, "at the request of Mr. Gatsby, we are going to play for you Mr. Vladimir Tostov's latest work, which attracted so much attention at Carnegie Hall last May. If you read the papers, you know there was a big sensation." He smiled and added, "Some sensation," and everybody laughed. "The piece is known," he concluded, "as Vladimir Tostov's Jazz History of the World." The nature of Mr. Tostov's composition escaped me, because just as it began, my eyes fell on Gatsby, standing alone on the marble steps and looking from one group to another with approving eyes. His tight tan skin was attractive on his face, and his short hair looked as though it were trimmed every day. I could see nothing sinister about him. I wondered if the fact that he was not drinking helped to separate him from his guests. When the Jazz History of the World was over, girls were putting their heads on men's shoulders in a puppyish, merry way. Girls were fainting backward, playfully into men's arms, even into groups, knowing that someone would stop their falls. But no one fainted backward on Gatsby, and no French bob touched Gatsby's shoulder, and no singing quartets were formed with Gatsby's head as one link. "I beg your pardon." Gatsby's butler was suddenly standing beside us. "Miss Baker?" he inquired. "I beg your pardon, but Mr. Gatsby would like to speak to you alone." "With me?" she exclaimed in surprise. "Yes, madam." She got up slowly, raising her eyebrows at me in astonishment, and followed the butler toward the house. I noticed that she wore her evening dress, all her dresses, like sports clothes. There was a liveliness about her movements as if she had first learned to walk upon golf courses on clean, fresh mornings. I was alone, and it was almost 2. For some time, intriguing sounds had been coming from a long, many-windowed room which was above the terrace. To escape from Jordan's student, who was now engaged in an obstetrical conversation with 2 chorus girls, and who begged me to join him, I went inside. The large room was full of people. One of the girls in yellow was playing the piano, and beside her stood a tall, red-haired young lady from a famous chorus, engaged in song. She had drunk some champagne, and during her song she had decided suddenly that everything was very, very sad. She was not only singing, she was crying too. Whenever there was a pause in the song, she filled it with heavy breathing, broken sobs, and then started again in a trembling soprano. The tears ran down her cheeks, not freely, however, for when they came into contact with her heavily beaded eyelashes, they became an inky color and continued the rest of their way in slow black little rivers. A humorous suggestion was made that she should sing the notes on her face, at which point she threw up her hands, sank into a chair, and went off into a deep drunken sleep. "She had a fight with a man who says he's her husband," explained a girl at my elbow. I looked around. Most of the remaining women were now having fights with men said to be their husbands. Even Jordan's party, the quartet from East Egg, were divided by a disagreement. One of the men was talking with curious intensity to a young actress, and his wife, after attempting to laugh at the situation in a dignified and indifferent way, broke down completely and resorted to flank attacks. At intervals, she appeared suddenly at his side like an angry diamond and hissed, "You promised," into his ear. The reluctance to go home was not limited to unruly men. The hall was at present occupied by two miserably sober men and their highly indignant wives. The wives were sympathizing with each other in slightly raised voices. "Whenever he sees I'm having a good time, he wants to go home. Never heard anything so selfish in my life. We're always the first ones to leave. So are we." "Well, we're almost the last tonight," said one of the men sheepishly. "The orchestra left half an hour ago." In spite of the wives' agreement that such ill will was unbelievable, the argument ended in a short struggle, and both wives were lifted, kicking, into the night. As I waited for my hat in the hall, the door of the library opened, and Jordan Baker and Gatsby came out together. He was saying some last word to her, but the eagerness in his manner changed suddenly into formality as several people approached him to say goodbye. Jordan's party were calling impatiently to her from the porch, but she lingered for a moment to shake hands. "I've just heard the most amazing thing," she whispered. "How long were we in there?"
"Why, about an hour."
"It was simply amazing," she repeated abstractedly. "But I swore I wouldn't tell it, and here I am teasing you." She yawned gracefully in my face. "Please come and see me. Phone book, under the name of Mrs. Sigourney Howard, my aunt." She was hurrying off as she talked. Her brown hand waved a playful salute as she melted into her party at the door. Rather ashamed that on my first appearance I had stayed so late, I joined the last of Gatsby's guests who were gathered around him. I wanted to explain that I'd hunted for him early in the evening and to apologize for not having known him in the garden. "Don't mention it," he told me eagerly. "Don't give it another thought, old sport. And don't forget we're going up in the hydroplane tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Then the butler behind his shoulder, "Philadelphia wants you on the phone, sir." "All right, in a minute. Tell them I'll be right there. Good night."
"Good night. Good night."
He smiled, and suddenly there seemed to be a pleasant importance in being among the last guests to go, as if he had wanted it all the time. "Good night, old sport. Good night." But as I walked down the steps, I saw that the evening was not quite over. 50 feet from the door, a dozen headlights illuminated a strange and turbulent scene. In the ditch beside the road, right side up but missing one wheel, rested a new coupe which had left Gatsby's drive not 2 minutes before. The sharp corner of a wall was responsible for the detachment of the wheel, which was now getting considerable attention from half a dozen curious chauffeurs. However, as they had left their cars and were blocking the road, harsh cries from those in the rear had been heard for some time and added to the already violent confusion of the scene. A man in a long coat had got out from the wreck and now stood in the middle of the road, looking from the car to the tire and from the tire to the observers in a pleasant, puzzled way. "See," he explained, "it went in the ditch." The fact was extremely astonishing to him, and I recognized first the unusual quality of wonder, and then the man. It was the patron of Gatsby's library. "How'd it happen?" He shrugged his shoulders. "I know nothing about mechanics," he said decisively. "But how did it happen? Did you run into the wall?"
"Don't ask me," said Owl-Eyes, washing his hands of the whole matter. "I know very little about driving, next to nothing. It happened, and that's all I know."
"Well, if you're a poor driver, you oughtn't to try driving at night."
"But I wasn't even trying," he explained. "I wasn't even trying."
A shocked silence fell upon the bystanders. "Do you want to commit suicide? You're lucky it was just a wheel, a bad driver, and not even trying."
"You don't understand," explained the criminal. "I wasn't driving. There's another man in the car."
The shock that followed this declaration was expressed in a long, "Ah, ha, ha, ha," as the door of the coupe swung slowly open. The crowd, it was now a crowd, stepped back, and when the door had opened wide, there was a ghostly pause. Then very gradually, part by part, a pale individual stepped out of the wreck, touching the ground with a large, uncertain dancing shoe. Blinded by the glare of the headlights and confused by the continuous groaning of the horns, the apparition stood swaying for a moment before he noticed the man in the coat.
"What's the matter?" he asked calmly. "Did we run out of gas? Look!" half a dozen fingers pointed at the amputated wheel. He stared at it for a moment, and then looked upward as though he suspected that it had dropped from the sky. "It came off," someone explained. He nodded. "At first I didn't notice we'd stopped." A pause, then, taking a long breath and straightening his shoulders, he remarked in a determined voice, "Wonder if tell me where there's a gas line station?" At least a dozen men, some of them a little better off than he was, explained to him that wheel and car were no longer joined by any physical bond. "Back out," he suggested after a moment. "Put her in reverse." "But the wheel's off," he hesitated. "No harm in trying," he said. The noise of the horns had reached a crescendo, and I turned away and cut across the lawn toward home. I glanced back once. A cookie of a moon was shining over Gatsby's house, making the night fine as before, and surviving the laughter and the sound of his still glowing garden. A sudden emptiness seemed to flow now from the windows and the great doors. The figure of the host stood on the porch in complete isolation, his hand up in a formal gesture of farewell. Reading over what I have written so far, I see I have given the impression that the events of three nights, several weeks apart, were all that absorbed me. On the contrary, they were just casual events in a busy summer, and, until much later, they absorbed me much less than my personal affairs. Most of the time I worked. In the early morning, I hurried down across Lower New York to the Probity Trust. I knew the other clerks and young bond salesmen by their first names, and lunched with them in dark, crowded restaurants on little pig sausages and mashed potatoes and coffee. I even had a short affair with a girl who lived in Jersey City and worked in the accounting department, but her brother began throwing mean looks in my direction, so when she went on her vacation in July, I let it blow quietly away. I took dinner usually at the Yale Club. For some reason, it was the gloomiest event of my day. And then I went upstairs to the library and studied investments and securities for an hour. There were generally a few rioters around, but they never came into the library, so it was a good place to work. After that, if the night was pleasant, I strolled down Madison Avenue, past the old Murray Hill Hotel, and over 33rd Street to the Pennsylvania Station. I began to like New York, the energetic, adventurous feel of it at night, and the satisfaction that the constant flicker of men and women and machines gives to the restless eye. I like to walk up Fifth Avenue and pick out romantic women from the crowd and imagine that in a few minutes I was going to enter into their lives and no one would ever know or disapprove. Sometimes in my mind, I followed them to their apartments on the corners of hidden streets and they turned and smiled back at me before they disappeared into warm darkness. At the magical metropolitan twilight, I felt a nostalgic loneliness sometimes and felt it in others. Poor young clerks who hung around in front of windows, waiting until it was time for a solitary restaurant dinner. Young clerks in the dusk, wasting the most poignant moments of night and life. Again at 8 o'clock, when the dark lanes of the 40s were lined with taxicabs bound for the theater district, I felt a sinking in my heart. Forms leaned together in the taxis as they waited, and voices sang, and there was laughter from unheard jokes, and lighted cigarettes made circles inside. Imagining that I too was hurrying towards fun and sharing their intimate excitement, I wished them well. For a while, I lost sight of Jordan Baker, and then in midsummer, I found her again. At first, I was flattered to go places with her because she was a golf champion and everyone knew her name. Then it was something more. I wasn't actually in love, but I felt a sort of tender curiosity. The bored, haughty face that she turned to the world hid something, and one day I found what it was. When we were on a house party together up in Warwick, she left a borrowed car out in the rain with the top down, and then lied about it. And suddenly I remembered the story about her that had escaped me that night at Daisy's. At her first big golf tournament, there was a row that nearly reached the newspapers, a suggestion that she had cheated in the semifinal round. The thing approached the proportions of a scandal, then died away. A caddy withdrew his statement, and the only other witness admitted that he might have been mistaken. The incident and the name had remained together in my mind. Jordan Baker instinctively avoided clever, shrewd men, and now I saw that this was because she felt safer this way. She was incurably dishonest. She wasn't able to tolerate being at a disadvantage. I suppose she had begun practicing deceit when she was very young in order to keep that cool, insolent smile turned to the world and yet satisfy the demands of her hard, bouncy body. It made no difference to me. Dishonesty in a woman is a thing you never blame deeply. I was casually sorry, and then I forgot. It was on that same house party that we had a curious conversation about driving a car. It started because she passed so close to some workman that our fender flicked a button on one man's coat. "You're a rotten driver," I protested. "Either you ought to be more careful, or you oughtn't to drive at all." "I am careful." "No, you're not." "Well, other people are," she said lightly. "What's that got to do with it?" "They'll keep out of my way," she insisted. "It takes two to make an accident." "Suppose you met somebody just as careless as yourself." "I hope I never will," she answered. "I hate careless people. That's why I like you." Her gray, sun-strained eyes stared straight ahead, but she had deliberately shifted our relations, and for a moment, I thought I loved her. But I am slow-thinking and full of interior rules that act as brakes on my desires. And I knew that first I had to get myself definitely out of that situation back home. I'd been writing letters once a week and signing them, "Love, Nick." And all I could think of was how, when that certain girl played tennis, a faint mustache of perspiration appeared on her upper lip. Nevertheless, there was a vague understanding that had to be tactfully broken off before I was free. Everyone believes they have at least one of the cardinal virtues, and this is mine. I am one of the few honest people that I have ever known.